States was warned long ago.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
And then warned again, not long after.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
In fact, the U.S. is still warned to this very day. But are you listening?
What if the American people woke up and understood that the official reasons for going to war are almost always based on lies and promoted by war propaganda in order to serve special interests? What if we as a nation came to realize that the quest for empire eventually destroys all great nations? What if the American people learned the truth? That our foreign policy has nothing to do with national security, that it never changes from one administration to the next.
And this is Republic Theory with Dallas Andrews and Warren Dyson.
And welcome once again to Republic Theory. I'm Dallas Andrews along with Warren Dyson. And it's Jackalope 105 FM. Warren, how you doing?
I'm great tonight.
Like Tony the Tiger great, or what are we talking about?
Like Tony the Tiger Gray, it has been a really good day so far, and I'm excited about tonight's show. I think it's going to be the best so far, mostly because, well, we'll get into why here in just a little bit. I'm sure there's other stuff we want to cover before we get to the big news.
Yeah, Warren, we don't want to give away the secret just yet, do we? Now let's give it away.
Oh, why not? Yeah, we can give it away. I will let you do the honors. Feel free.
Well, tonight we do have our first ever guest on the show, and we're really excited to have this gentleman, and for a couple of reasons. And as we've been continuing our discussion on the events of September 11, 2001, obviously, and specifically the controversy surrounding the events, Warren and I have taken a great deal of time over the last several years, in fact, but specifically towards this show. Towards gathering bits and pieces of information that I guess offer perspective as well as contradictions regarding both the 9/11 Commission and this fictitious cockamamie, I don't even know the word for it, Warren, this stuff that we've been given. And our guest tonight has a quite decorated resume, you might say. Not only does he hold a degree in civil engineering from Southern Methodist University, aka SMU in Dallas, Texas, but also ended up going in the military direction at around the time of the Vietnam War, will allow him to elaborate, but he specifically ended up flying combat in the Navy, so he is a naval aviator, ended up a naval commander, and as if that weren't enough, yes, there's more. Also served as a commercial airline pilot with Pan Am through 1992. Our guest is Ted Muga. Ted, welcome to Republic Theory. We're Warren and I are both excited to have you on the show. And to start with, I have to say you've got one hell of a resume.
Well, it's a resume. I'm not sure about it being a hell of a resume, but it's all I got.
Well, you have... I wanted to start off because we do want you to elaborate some on your flight experience, because obviously flight is one of the key elements surrounding 9/11. But we spent a good deal of time on our last show discussing the eyewitness testimony concerning both citizens, WTC workers, rescue workers, and so forth. As far as explosives, people felt that there was explosions. So with respect to the WTC situation, I understand that you're also you're a civil engineer from SMU, graduated from there, and since most people know basically what a pilot, I'm willing to bet many, if not most, Americans don't really know what a civil engineer does. So elaborate on that if you would.
Well, a civil engineer actually covers a wide range of interest in the world of science and everything. Structural engineering, of course, is the area that I gravitated toward, but there's hydraulic engineering. You see all of the surveying that you see around towns and everything, airport design, city design, shopping center design. This is all done by civil engineering. And my particular area that I like and that I went into when I was in school was structural engineering, which is in fact the design and building of structures, both of course wood and steel and concrete.
So you basically covered all three of those at one time or another?
Yes, that's correct.
So understanding that you have the engineering background that you do, that makes, I understand it's a rather broad topic. Elaborate, if you would, on your flight experience.
Okay, flying after getting out of school, I worked actually a couple years for an engineering company, actually in bridge design, railroad bridges specifically, but the draft was on the horizon, and you can just avoid that just so long. And so finally, when there was no more delays available, I came into the Navy. I finally came in on the in the aviation program, going to Pensacola, and after completing 18 months of flight training, I ended out here in San Diego. I was flying E-1s, which is an airborne early warning twin-engine carrier-based aircraft, and I served a total of 5 years of back. I remained in the reserves after that for a full 20 years, so that I eventually retired as a Navy commander. After my active duty period in 68, the latter part of 68, I gravitated toward commercial aviation, and I went on and was hired on by Pan American World Airways, my first flying out of San Francisco. There was a long period of furloughs in there, but eventually back in, and my last part of my career with Pan American was domiciled in Berlin, where I flew there for the latter part of the 1980s. And then, as you know, as the wall came down and everything, Pan American was replaced as the carrier in the occupied city there. And I ended up back in Miami for the last year, year and a half of my career, flying 727s out of Miami.
Well, given what your past experience has taught you, obviously you would have had some opinions regarding 9/11. I think that's safe to say. Of course, we had a chance to visit last night as we were setting up your appearance tonight. If you would, for the audience especially, talk about what led you to first question the official story, if you ever even bought it.
My first questioning or my first acceptance of the incident was actually blowback. I just assumed that we were getting paid back for all of the atrocities that we have participated in around the world and everything by our own military and covert actions of the CIA and whatever. So my first inclination was just blowback. It wasn't until about a year and a half later on a NOVA presentation, and it was from an engineering perspective, where they were explain and describe the destructions of the World Trade Centers. And that's what actually brought my first interest. And during the presentation on NOVA, they started talking about what came to be referred to all around the media is a pancake theory, and that's what raised the flag for me, because I don't remember or had ever heard of a pancake theory in structural engineering. And so at that point I started listening more closely to all the details, and it was at that time that the details were not adding up to what I had learned in the world of science.
So you're essentially saying there is no such thing as a pancake theory, or it's exactly that, a theory.
It's not, you can have structural pancake, but not in steel structures. Steel structures just will not fail in that manner.
Right. And, well, that's been my understanding as well. So Now, given the aviation background you have, I'm assuming maybe it was a little while down the road before you started considering the plausibility or the likelihood that these four alleged attacks could have happened the way they did. I mean, at what point did that start to sound a little odd?
Well, shortly after the red flag went up from the engineering point of view, I immediately started looking at more details. And, of course, the aviation discrepancies and contradictions were just all over the place. And so at that point, I knew that it was not blowback. It had to have been an inside job. There are just too many discrepancies in the details that were being put out by the media. The most obvious one, of course, was the Pentagon, where a 757 was supposed to have flown into it. That is the most thing in the world, and how anyone can go beyond that particular detail and still believe the government's theory is beyond my imagination. I just can't imagine that. In other words, the amount of evidence that is out there that would indicate that the government's theory is completely flawed is overwhelming.
Go ahead, Ted, I did just have a question for you here. As far as your aviation background and what you saw at the Pentagon, as a professional pilot throughout most of your life here, have you ever seen any type of crash scene that did not have a lot of telltale debris about what type of object crashed at that spot?
I've seen photographs and summaries of crash scenes, and I've seen many on both military and civilian, and invariably there are more than enough debris around and remaining parts of an aircraft. Specifically, you have to take into account the engines, the makeup of the engines that are on these aircraft. Especially the jet engines, where the burner cans are essentially these titanium steel composite structures, which are essentially indestructible. You're not going to destroy them. These burner cans are burning at the highest temperature that jet fuel can burn at. I mean, they have all these computers in there in the fuel systems, and those and that's the whole idea of the jet, is to getting the max bang for your buck. And those burner cans are essentially indestructible. And for anyone to say that they're going to vaporize or melt is beyond one's imagination. And that would just referring you to the two engines. A next part that should raise flags with everyone is the landing gear assembly. That the steel that they use in that is some of the highest grade steel that they can make, and if you can imagine that steel landing gear assembly is taking a beating every time a plane lands, and for the whole life of the airplane, for the most part, I mean they will replace portions of it, but for the most part that steel is staying intact, and there is no way that it is going to vaporize or melt in a landing like that. It's between the landing gear assembly and the two engines, you invariably will find them along with the flight data and cockpit voice recorder.
And I assume that the same type of description would be true for, say, the Flight 93 Shanksville crash, even when you have a plane that is supposed to have crashed at a 90-degree angle into the ground. Those types of things would still survive that kind of impact, right?
They would be easily distinguishable and found right there, right on the scene. They're not going to flutter away in the breeze, as they say. It would be definitely in the area.
I did have a follow-up question here, just with your experience as a pilot. My own experience as far as aircraft goes is exceedingly limited. The closest thing I've ever had to flying an airplane was an uncle of mine who worked for the Air Force, and I flew a C-130 simulator very, very poorly once. But it's a very complex machine by any account. But some of the maneuvers that were described by so-called witnesses or by the official story are exceptionally difficult for me to wrap my head around. For example, a 757, I had heard one eyewitness account of the one in Shanksville actually flying inverted with the tail fin down. I mean, can a 757 even fly upside down?
I would doubt whether it would be flying. Now, I've heard stories in the past where there have been some of these wild test pilots going out over the ocean and taking some of these aircraft out there and taking them for a spin out there. But as far as flying a commercial airplane, and especially by amateurs, if that plane is upside down, it is not flying, it's falling. It's on its way down.
And as far as the maneuver that Hani Hanyor was supposed to have made in order to make his attack on the Pentagon, I'm familiar with your Alex Jones interview where you described mm-hmm. some of the difficulties with that, but I was hoping you could recap a little bit of that information here. How difficult is that maneuver to pull off, that 7,000-foot descent, and what is it, like a 320-degree spirally turn mm-hmm. while you're doing that?
It is a difficult maneuver. I'm sure it could be done if you have. I mean, there are some very talented pilots out there, and if you were flying some of the fighter jets, they could make that maneuver well within quite easily. As far as just general commercial pilots that just fly the line every day, that would be quite difficult. In other words, I would never say that it's impossible, but it would be highly improbable. And when you go to the next stage of having an inexperienced pilot that, quite frankly, couldn't even fly a Cessna 172, if you would put him in that cockpit, the degree of probability would approach zero at that point. And so we're dealing with not so much whether it's possible or not, but how probable is it?
And I guess in this case, it's just not real probable.
Not at all.
Let me tell you real quickly, here's my flight experience, which is even more limited than Warren's, although I shoot him down in a online World War II flight sim constantly. Right, Warren?
Yeah, you can do that train of thought if you'd like. That's an even bigger conspiracy theory than the government's official story.
Rightio. Ted, we were talking last night, and just, I mentioned that we're, fans of flight on computers. Very much scaled down and very simple, yet I recall first starting to play this kind of a game, and just in a World War II setting, we're not even talking about jets, just the whole dynamic of flight when all you've ever done is Space Invaders and football games, it's a completely different thing altogether. And what I came to realize is that a great deal of experience has to be acquired before you can do anything related to flight. And we just discussed the fact that maneuver was not very probable. But let's back up a little bit. We've got hijacked airplanes, and I wanted you to elaborate, or basically, share with the audience what your thoughts were regarding these amateurs hopping in cockpits with little, if any, training at all, and then being able to even find their way back to the targets they intended to hit.
That's a very good point. As they described the hijacking, supposedly of Flight 77, it occurred in just a little over a 3-minute period. Apparently, it was a short process. But at that point, there, with amateur pilots in the cockpit, they are now in charge of navigating. And at that point, it really raises a red flag, because unless you're familiar with all of the navigation points, all of the radios, not to mention the assistance from all the various radar sectors in the area, there is a real question in my mind how they could have pulled this story up, and heading all the way across Pennsylvania, and we're talking about Flight 77 supposedly heading across Pennsylvania and into Ohio and then turning around and coming back without any assistance from the local radar controllers and everything is very, very improbable and very unlikely. I just can't imagine being able to navigate, especially at those heights. I mean, we're talking, I think they were around 35,000 feet as they were transiting or making their turn in Ohio and coming back. And once again, the plane was never identified conclusively, or if ever, not, or even close to conclusively, as being Flight 77. It was just a blip on the radar at that point. And so we don't know who was doing the navigating at that point, if in fact there was any navigation being done at all. And then, of course, making it back all the way to the Washington, D.C. area and completing that 30-degree turn and taking it into and taking it into the Pentagon, a designated target, would be extremely difficult. I would suggest that you and your audience members that are listening, check out pilotsfor911truth.org. It's a website that's all set up there. It's a link that is very, very interesting, and it has just hundreds and hundreds of military and commercial pilots and their statements about all of these events. And they all, every one of them, will agree that the degree of probability just isn't there to match or to match the story that the government has put out on this hijacking.
So you could basically liken this to, and correct me if I'm wrong, give me your assessment of this. You could, I like to use analogies for people in general, because people really don't know a whole lot about this, you know, outside of the official story, unless they're like you, myself, Warren, a good number of people that we all know, and many people we don't know. Sometimes you have to simplify this. I mean, would you expect a 7-year-old to be able to hop into a city bus, start it up, get it in reverse, back it out, and drive it across town? It just really, is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? Not even close.
I'll go along with you. And one of the other anomalies that we're talking about as far as the hijacking goes, and it brings into question whether these planes were actually hijacked at all. There's no real evidence that they were. Generally, anytime a pilot has a problem with the aircraft, they will contact the local radar sector and advise them of their problem. In the case of a hijacking, there's a little transponder that they can flip with very minimum effort, and in a split second, I might add, and it sends a signal directly to the radar units that are following these aircraft that a hijacking is in progress, or at least the code is there. They will, of course, call the aircraft and have them confirm the code if it's correct. If there's no answer, of course, they will assume that it is hijacking, that it has been hijacked, in which case they will start following their checklist and get the scramble the pilots from the local National Guard units in the area up to find out what's really going on. But if you have to say if it's possible, once again you go back to that little scenario. It's possible that one pilot may have forgotten to do it, but then now you have to say that there's two pilots and the little transponder is accessible to both of them. So now you have to say both pilots forgot to put in that code, and then if that's not enough of a possibility for you, you have to go to the second plane and the third plane and finally a fourth plane where all eight pilots failed to enter a hijack code. And at that point, while these debunkers still think that it's possible, it's highly, highly improbable. And so getting back to just the hijacking part of the government story, there has been no evidence whatsoever that any of the four planes was in fact hijacked, and that's primarily referring to a lot of the supposedly cell phone calls or air phone calls from the airplanes depicting this event.
Now, Ted, I did have to follow up something on the hijackings there. In your experience as a commercial pilot, mm-hmm. is there anything that would make not one, but in this case, like you said, eight commercial pilots to give up control of their aircraft to hijackers? In other words, to allow them to fly the plane. Is there anything that you can imagine as a commercial pilot that would motivate them to get up out of the seat and let somebody else fly that aircraft?
Well, my experience from all of the military pilots that I have known in the past and commercial pilots with Pan Am, I can't even think of one that would even come close to thinking about giving up an aircraft to anyone. In other words, if you were ever confronted in the cockpit you can maneuver the airplane very, very easily with just a slight movement of the yoke, and essentially decapitate the poor guy in the cockpit if he's not strapped in. You know, with just a jarring motion of the airplane up to the ceiling and all the way back down to the floor. Unfortunately, it would affect everyone in the airplane that isn't strapped in. But once again, you have a dossier at that point, and if someone came in threatening the cockpit, you could easily outmaneuver them in that way. Some pilots would be more aggressive, and really, I'm sure they're maneuvered. Everyone has their own favorite maneuver to ensure that a person that's not strapped in is not no longer a threat.
So I'm going to kind of try to summarize this, because I'm literally, you know, considering what you're telling me. It just occurred to me that, oh, it's not just one pilot in a jetliner. It is actually two. Again, this is one of those things that you know, but you forget about. You know, when I was a young boy, I was on a flight probably to Las Vegas, and I remember the stewardess way back then. This would have been late 70s when you could still do this. You know, they invited me to go up and see the inside of the cockpit for a minute, you know, that kind of thing. So most people are aware that there's a pilot and a co-pilot. But if you're following along, we understand that there's not one but two pilots. We also understand that, according to the story, these hijackers, they weren't exactly well-armed. I mean, it's not like a box cutter can't do some harm. But we also know that the probability doesn't really exist to any significant measure that untrained pilots would want to take control of an airplane they would know nothing about it. And so if you start to tie in the literal aspects of the story, Ted, it just makes less and less sense the deeper you go, does it not?
It's very, very improbable that pilots would get up out of the seat. Now, once again, the old hijacking stories that you hear about occasionally back in Europe and everything, in the East and everything, where they come in with obviously firearms in many cases, and they want to be they're hijacking the airplane, and they're actually want to be taken to, say, Morocco or,
right,
or Cuba or whoever. And the first thing that comes to the pilot's mind, once again, is the fuel. Can they make it to where these people want to go? And then, quite frankly, they're thinking about, are they dressed for this type? In other words, a pilot's just concerned about flying an airplane from one point to the other. If they're forced to fly there because of a hijacking, well, that's their job. They can do it. They can navigate it. They can get assistance if necessary from various radar controls. And if a person has a firearm in the cockpit, they'll fly it. They'll fly it wherever you want to go, as long as there's enough fuel. But this is more of a case of commandeering, where you're actually taking a cockpit or a pilot out of the seat and taking over the airplane. And that is not going to happen, not with the pilots that I have known in the past. It's very possible that you might have a wuss as a pilot. I've never known one, but you would have to have more than one. You'd have to have two that would be willing to give up an airplane. And as I've told people so many times, especially wives ask, what would it take to take a remote control from your husband in the living room? That's the little 4 or 5 ounce piece of electronic equipment. And then compare that to being able to take away a 200 ton 757 away from a highly trained pilot. It's just not probable.
It's also rather interesting that when you think of all the hijackings that have occurred, I can remember several over the course of my life when I was a lot younger. And it's interesting how in those hijackings, as you just said, they demand that the pilot fly the plane elsewhere because they don't know how themselves.
That's correct. And that is why the government story indicates that the planes were commandeered. In other words, they were taken over. And there is no way, the degree of probability is so low that one pilot and then two and then go all the way up to 8 full pilots, it's just not possible.
Ted, for something you said before, you indicated that everybody has their favorite maneuver to go ahead and throw somebody off balance. Does that indicate that as a commercial pilot, you received some relatively extensive anti-terrorism, anti-hijacking training?
I didn't. We had a few scenarios in simulator training, but it was very minimal, and I was flying out of Berlin in the 80s, and so we just never did have extensive training in that area. However, pilots know, because they're going through turbulent air and everything all the time at those altitudes, and it's very, very easily to take someone out of the picture if you have to. In other words, by just moving the airplane, just by grabbing the yoke and pushing it forward just a slight amount, would have sent a guy up to the ceiling, and then by pulling the yoke back sharply, he would be flat on the ground. He wouldn't be a threat at all at that point. Other pilots might want to roll the airplane. You couldn't stand up in a cockpit and control yourself if a pilot didn't want you to. And so, as far as having a favorite maneuver, I'm sure a lot of pilots would come up with their own little scenario of how to handle the situation. But I'll tell you right now, unless a person had a high-powered firearm there asking you to go to a different destination, there is not going to be a hijack. There wouldn't be a hijacking, and definitely not a commandeering of an airplane.
Now, the World Trade Centers, as far as the designers in the early 70s were concerned, it was intended to withstand the impact of Boeing 707s. To your knowledge, is a 767, roughly the same dimensions as far as weight and width and that type of thing as a 707? Would it have been that much more of an impact in comparison between the two aircraft?
I've read information on this, and I understand that it's possible that the 707 may have had been able to carry more fuel, but the 757 could have had a greater speed going into it. But once again, the discrepancy or the difference between the two just wouldn't make that much of a difference going into a building like that. The kinetic energy of a plane going in at 300, 400 knots, just by the interviews of the designers and the architects of the building, they're designed to withstand this penetration of an aircraft. And as far as the diesel fuel, if you saw all of the old pictures on television, the ball of fire, they estimated at least 80% of all the fuel was taken care of or ignited within seconds, and then the rest of the fuel probably burned up in less than 15 or 20 minutes after that. So then you were just talking about a regular building fire, which would not ever become hot enough or destructive enough to start bringing a building down. And I'm sure you've read these or seen the videos and the audio of the firemen in the building where they're saying that they just needed a couple of more lines up there and they could put the fire out. So
right.
As far as the design of the building, it was more than capable of handling a single airplane or two airplanes or three, and I've understood that they could handle that.
Right. It's funny how I understand that the shock and the shock and awe, for lack of a better term, that all of us to an extent were under that day. It was very easy to see this unprecedented sight of this jetliner crashing into a building and then easily being skewed in any direction that the mainstream media wanted to send you because of the fascination over what you just saw. But when you really look at the facts, I mean, obviously you're comfortable with the stated fact that the buildings were built to sustain multiple impacts.
Well, only from the interviews from the original builders of the building and everything, that's all I have to go on. But one of the other areas that you might want to look into and get all this information from pilots for 9/11 Truth is the maneuvering of those particular flights going into the trade centers. The maneuvering of them at those high speeds and that high rate of descent, being able to hit a designated target without any training at all. There is one incident where a 737 instructor actually had his students, and when I say students, these are pilots. They were just in there for their 6 months training, but he had them try it, and over five or six times they still could not make that maneuver and hit a designated target like the Twin Towers in a simulator. And so it would be very, very difficult for an amateur and highly improbable. I keep using the term highly improbable because when you think about what we are in this huge universe, everything is somewhat possible. And so I always use the term probability, and all I can say is the degree of probability is so low, you have to be willing to accept some or be willing to ask questions about the government's official theory about the hijacking.
It's kind of like suggesting that you, your wife, Nalise, and your next four or five closest family members all won the lottery on the same day. Because, yes, it is probable, or it is possible, but it's remarkably improbable. It just, it wouldn't happen.
The problem I think we're having with this, with the 9/11 story that we're discussing, is not so much the evidence. There is overwhelming evidence that the government story is flawed and, quite frankly, not even possible. The problem we have is getting our citizens to wake up and participate in this democratic experiment that we are trying in this country right now. The effort that it's going to take is extensive. People are going to have to work hard to maintain this democracy, and you got to be willing to, participate. And when you see a discrepancy in what our government is doing, you have to take actions. And unfortunately, I feel that such a large percentage of our population are living in a little capsule, a little comfort capsule, and they just do not want to be disturbed. And when we take or present the evidence that we are talking about, it's very difficult for them to accept it. And that is, I think, getting people to wake up is more of a problem than actually having evidence. There's overwhelming evidence that there is not, when you think about the government theory, just think about this, there is not one detail of the government's theory, from starting with the initial hijacking to the last plane going down in Shanksville, there is not one detail, including the cell phone, air phone calls, that have been proven or can be proven by science.
Ted, I did have something I wanted to ask you about the your experience as a naval aviator. When it comes to the Defense Department's reaction that day on NORAD, specifically in response to hijackings, was there anything on that day that was unusual about their response? In other words, is it a normal practice for these aircraft to have not been intercepted?
From what I know about NORAD and all of the procedures, all I can say is that what was unusual was that there was no action taken. There are many, many pilots, especially Air Force pilots out there, that can have a real good insight as to exactly how NORAD operates and everything. But just from the few experiences that I have known, and these are just stories, you know, airplanes that get lost up in the sky or have problems up there, they usually can scramble an aircraft up there and within seconds. And once again, when these guys scramble, they're not going up there to shoot anybody down. They're scrambling to get up there to see if they can find out what the problem is and see if they can help somebody come down safely. Invariably, that is the situation. And so on September the 11th, for these four airplanes to get airborne and supposedly have been hijacked, for NORAD not to respond, I can't explain it. There's just no excuse or no reason that I know of, from what I know about their procedures, that they would not have been up there within 15, 18 minutes at the most and to see what the problem was.
If you're tuning in a little bit late, you are tuned into Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM. We're visiting with Ted Muga, who is a former naval aviator, commercial pilot, and civil engineer. We were teasing him earlier, asking him he's going to get a resume going, but he seems to have a pretty good one. And we are discussing the events of September 11th, specifically the, I like to call it the government's conspiracy theory. I wanted to reflect quickly, not to put you on the spot, Ted, but do you recall the situation regarding Payne Stewart back in 1999?
Sure, that's one of them that I always refer to. Yeah, and they were able to get up there with in no time at all, and they knew there was a problem up there. It was nothing real dangerous, except that apparently lack of oxygen had decapacitated the crew and everything, and they just followed it. And as long as it finally went into a very low populated area, and as it ran out of fuel, they just let it go ahead and crash and everything.
Well, I guess there's not a whole lot you can do in that situation, but I think it's interesting that here we have precedents, and I want to hit a couple things regarding precedents, not regarding the whole tale, but here we have a somewhat well-publicized story about a professional golfer who unfortunately was killed along with others in a Learjet in 1999, in case you're not familiar with the story. And Ted, what was the term for that? Were they it capsized, or what happened to the cabin?
I'm not really sure exactly. They lost pressurization, and they were, I believe, at 30,000 feet, and they lost pressurization. Of course, it doesn't take any time at all, less than a minute, really, for them to lose consciousness up there at that altitude without oxygen or without pressurization in an aircraft. I'm not sure what caused it or what the reason was behind it or
right.
anything, but the plane was on autopilot, apparently, and it was just flying its course. But it was on a flight plan, and when it began to deviate from its flight plan, that's when the radar controllers took notice. And when it failed to respond to calls to the cockpit up there, when they failed to answer, they have a little checklist. It's a procedure, and I'm not sure if it's considered an immediate hijacking, but it's a situation that calls for him to find out why this plane is not flying his prescribed course that he should be flying up there. And so they had the jets up there. It was pretty easy. Apparently, after they got up there, they tell that the plane was on autopilot and it was just going straight ahead. And they just followed procedure and let it do, and followed procedure and ensure that the highest degree of safety was followed.
And again, though, but I think in that case, it was a couple of F-16 Fighting Falcons, I believe, that intercepted it, if I remember correctly. But nonetheless, whatever it was, we have a plane off course. That represents either a hijacking or, as you said, some degree of risk to the general public, because obviously what goes up has to come down at some point. And yet they responded within, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like it might have been as little as 20 minutes to 30 minutes there was F-16s scrambled to this jet. And so you still have some people, and I sometimes debate these people back and forth with emails and messages on YouTube, where I look at a lot of stuff regarding everything, but obviously 9/11. And you've got people who don't believe that we have the ability to intercept an airplane, which, you know, I guess one analogy I could come up with is, you know, fighter jets, military fighter jets catching up to a jumbo jetliner is kind of like a rabbit chasing down a tortoise if they really want to catch it.
I don't have a problem with that, because they're either willing to accept a few facts of science or an aviation, or they're not. We run into this all the time in trying to talk to people about the evidence that shows that actually highlights the discrepancies of the government story. Many people just cannot go there. I mean, actually, what you need to do is almost bring in a psychologist or psychiatrist and talk about that, because people are very, very difficult to convince on details that they don't want to believe.
Right, right. Well, in this country, we're conditioned to, I believe that this starts as early as elementary school, and it continues through our state-run education system, which is an abject, outdated failure, in my opinion. You guys may not agree, but I do. That's what I think. And then you get into the media. You know, people are just so unaware. I mean, when you live in the bubble, you're really not aware of what's outside of it. And we do live in like that bubble we're talking about, Ted, or that comfort zone. I forget the phrase you used, but that is so profound, because we actually live in that in this country, which is why we brought you on this show, where people can stay tucked in their bed and listen to the show on their laptop. That's comfy, right? You know,
that's correct. Actually, it's very interesting that this program is actually highlighting the events of 9/11, because it's paramount that people at least be willing to look into the situation and ask questions. They don't have to believe everything, and so many of the debunkers come back with the concept of possibilities, and there's not much you can say about that because it is possible, but I always tried to guide them toward the idea of what is actually probable. And then there are so many other areas you can go into, whether it's the financial interest following the 9/11, the war interest following 9/11. But as far as the details and the facts from an engineering point of view or an aviation point of view, they're all there. They're most easily available facts in the world. The websites are out there. The programs like yourself are all over the internet and a few newspapers. And it just has to, somehow or another, we have to get these people to be willing to at least get the interest or gather enough interest for that they would be willing to ask questions.
And when you live in a free country, there should be nothing wrong with at least asking questions. One more quick thing as our time is starting to wear down. I wanted to hit on one more thing regarding precedents, shifting gears back to the World Trade Centers and what they were or were not built to withstand. I remember the words of Condoleezza Rice. Especially at the time, we could have never imagined that. Well, we know that that's bogus now, but really, if you go back, I mean, I mentioned the Payne Stewart situation because here's a well-publicized example of NORAD in action, and then, but you can go back to the 1940s. You might know the year, but it seems like it was 1945. A B-25 Mitchell actually slammed into the Empire State Building.
That's right. I mean, that's, and it just sort of, the pictures that I saw, it just sort of stuck in there. But I would sort of suggest to all your listeners, if they would go, there's a website, it's called ae911truth.org. That's Architects and Engineers for 911truth.org. It's run by a young man, Richard Gage. And he has, over 900 registered architects and engineers that have signed on to his program. And they were, and it's essentially saying that all the evidence for the failure of the World Trade Centers points towards control. And so, if anyone is looking in that or is interested in the details of the evidence for controlled demolition, I would sure direct them toward ae911truth.org, and they have an immense amount of information there, and they have speakers around the country that are be willing to talk to you. And I would sure think that that would be the way to go.
Well, Ted, I'm really appreciative that you've had the chance to talk with us tonight and actually share a lot of this really good information and again, taking the time to talk to us. I know it's been a relatively decent conversation as far as length. But one really important follow-up question, what would you recommend not only people who are within the truth movement do, but what would you recommend if they're talking to somebody who has not been exposed to this? What types of things should that person who is new to the idea of possible conspiracy, where should they go to look first? You mentioned a couple of good resources here. Is there anything else that you would want to recommend to them?
Well, I think the primary link is 911truth.org, and that'll get you started toward an array of alternate links with information. And as I mentioned earlier, ae911truth.org, and then, of course, the one that I think is really, really exciting to watch is pilotsfor911truth.org. A lot of information there. And another one that you might be interested in is Patriots Question 9/11. Now, these are people that are not really part of the 9/11 movement as we think of it, but they're just patriots that are questioning many of the details of the government story, and they are asking for a new investigation. And once again, that's Patriots Question 9/11.org, a very interesting one. And there's military people on there, there's engineers, there's congressmen for 911truth.org. There's a lot of information out there. There's no excuse for not being able to find the information. It's just a matter of getting or having the interest and the desire to find the truth.
Ted, do you think that your wife is going to be a little upset with you if you don't mention San Diegans for 9/11 Truth as well?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll mention that. It's www.sd911truth.org, and it's my wife's unbelievable efforts to put together an unbelievable organization down here in San Diego, and it's San Diegans for 911truth.org. And if you happen to be in the San Diego area around December the 13th, we're going to have one of our 9/11 events here in San Diego, and the title of it is going to be Aeronautical Impossibilities of 9/11. And that should bring a lot of interest, and interest to many folks, especially if they happen to be in the area and they'd like to see a great program. And Elisa's really working day and night to put it. And your three programs that are on the internet are really, really interesting and clear as a bell. We're really impressed with what you guys are doing.
Ted, we appreciate your being on the show. We hope that sometime soon that you will come by, visit with us again. And all I can say is thank you for your service. Thank you for not just coming on the show, but going back to your military service. And thanks for being one of the true patriots that aren't afraid to not only question, but even demand answers.
Well, thank you both Dallas and Warren for having me on, and you guys have a good evening.
And Ted, you do the very same thing. Thank you once again for coming on the program. Ted Muga, our special guest on this edition of Republic Theory, and Warren, some pretty good perspective, I think.
Really, really good perspective. I tell you, a really great guy to talk to, and it's really nice to have an expert on to really validate some of the things that we've theorized about for all this time.
It really is. And how often do you find a civil engineer and naval aviator and a commercial air pilot all in one, you know?
Oh, I know. It's we couldn't have dreamed up a better guest to have on, especially for the first show. And Ted did a really wonderful job with that, and I am very appreciative of his time taken out of, I know, what is a busy schedule for him in order to take the time to talk to us.
And just as a final footnote, Ted and his wife, Nalise, both head up the San Diegans for 9/11 Truth. You can visit their website if you're a resident of Southern California, as I was up until very recently, sd911truth.org. is their website. Very active with events taking place at the Joyce Beer Center down in San Diego. Numerous speakers are in and out, so they are very active, and they're working it. And as Ted said at some point in the interview several minutes ago, it does take a lot of work to get people to just open their eyes, you know.
Yeah, and having somebody like Ted, who's very knowledgeable, in addition to a really good communicator, is so important for getting some of this information across. I mean, obviously, you and I, we can talk about it all day long, but he's really somebody in the know.
Yeah, he really is. And once again, Ted Muga, former civil engineer from SMU, naval aviator, Navy commander, and commercial pilot with Pan Am. So indeed, he does have tremendous perspective on what flying an airplane is, and a thing or two about engineering, and lending us some perspective tonight as far as why exactly the World Trade Centers should not have come anywhere near the complete collapse that we witnessed that morning. A few other websites that Ted mentioned, that I know, Warren, you've been by these. I know I have. You have Pilots for 9/11 Truth, exactly as it sounds, Pilots for 911truth.org. That is their website. And I know that Ted and next week's guest, Dwayne Dietz, who spent many, many years with NASA, he will be our guest next week, by the way, spent numerous years with NASA, and both Ted and Dwayne, highly active with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Their website is ae911.org, and of course 911truth.org, very large active organization as well. Warren, many people really waking up to this thing.
There are a lot. I'm getting a lot of really good feedback from people who have heard the show, from people who had never really considered the types of things that we were presenting here, which partially I find surprising, because again, I expect a lot of people are aware of 9/11, and I assumed a lot of people would have questions about it, but but not many people do. And so when we present this information, and I've been getting a lot of good feedback about the information we've been presenting, it's been a dramatic change for many people. And there's so many resources out there that I'm able to direct people to. I'm very thankful for people like Dwayne and like Ted who are organizing this and sharing that type of information.
Absolutely. And there was an analogy that that I had picked up on a couple of years ago that I may have fired it your way, Warren, during one of our lengthy conversations about this. For amateur pilots to commandeer an aircraft, and I also found that interesting that Ted really did a good job of distinguishing the difference between a hijacking, which did not occur that day, and an actual commandeering of these aircrafts. Hijackings we've seen. This is when people take over the cockpit and demand that the pilot, because they're the only ones who know how to fly the plane, take it where they want it to go. Commandeering the aircraft is different, and that is something that's virtually unprecedented. I think there's a reason for that, and I fall back on this analogy. The idea that amateurs with little, if any, flight experience of any kind could hop into the cockpit of a modern-day jetliner and successfully fly the planes, not only keep them in the air, which I'll grant you that, keep the yoke right in the middle, and I suppose you can keep it from diving or climbing up and stalling out, but to navigate and then to maneuver these big, cumbersome jet planes, having never done it before, I would equate this to, well, I don't know if you've done this before, Andrew, but going to the local ice skating rink and putting ice skates on for the first time and then being asked to go perform figure skating maneuvers, you know?
I do know. And the only time I've been to an ice skating rink, I guarantee you the only maneuver I knew was how to fall down, and that doesn't score you very well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I recall back in Fresno, I did a celebrity hockey match once. It was only the second time I've ever been on ice skates, and I hadn't done it prior to 2003, let's say 2004, early 2004 perhaps. I had not skated prior to that since 1984, so about a 20-year gap. And I'm gonna tell you something: you don't just hop on and throw on the skates and expect to be able to perform with any level of competence. So anywho, Warren, I know you had something you want to wrap up with.
I do. It's going to be this week's rule for you debunkers out there. and this is going to be an interesting one. This goes back to a lot of the feedback that I've been getting recently. One of the challenges I've been getting is when it comes to Shanksville, when it comes to the Pentagon, what about the phone calls? That's a question I get again and again and again.
Yes.
And frankly, people, you can give it up with you, what about the phone calls thing. Phone calls do not prove that those aircraft were in Shanksville or impacted the Pentagon. Phone calls prove that somebody can dial a phone. And nothing else. That's all they prove. And so what I want to get out there to people is, if you're trying to prove to me that an airplane crashed in Shanksville or that an airplane hit the Pentagon, show me an airplane in Shanksville or an airplane in the side of the Pentagon. Nothing else matters up until that point. If you can't prove that, then everything else is superfluous.
That's a very good point, because I mean, assuming that people could make those phone calls on 2011, which you couldn't even do, let's say that they were genuine phone calls made from airphones or whatever, very valid point that a phone call in itself proves absolutely nothing if you don't have the airplane. This is what I understand. That's a great rule, because I'm going to use that. I'm actually going to use that. If there's no airplane, then how could the call possibly be real?
Oh, that's correct. I mean, there's no way that you can take a phone call and extrapolate it into an airplane crash. If you were to take that to court, you'd be laughed out of the courtroom. But that's what they expect us to believe, and I, for one, am not going to believe it.
Oh, come on, believe it.
You know me, I don't believe anything.
He really doesn't. All right, Warren Dyson, great job tonight. Once again, Ted Muga, our guest this evening. Special thanks to him. And next week's guest, right here on Jackalope 105 FM, will be visiting with Dwayne Dietz. And we're going to discuss, discussing Manhattan, the World Trade Centers, the collapses, and so forth. And we're looking forward to it. Quickly, PatriotsQuestion911.org. Stop by, check it out. Also, 911truth.org. AE911.org and pilotsfor911truth.org. Fantastic resources. Have a great week. We will see you next week. Same time, same station. This is Dallas Andrews for Warren Dyson and Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM.